Welcome back to Tasteland. I am one of your co-hosts, Francis Sierra.
And I'm the other co-host, Daisy Alioto.
Okay, before we start today, we do want to do a call for listener questions. We're going to do a mailbag episode, maybe two if we get a lot of questions, over the holidays. So by Thursday, December 19th, if you could email tastelandpod@gmail.com, we'll put that in the show notes as well. Email us any questions. Voice notes are accepted too. We might even play it if it's a good one. But yeah, if you want to ask us a question, we're going to do a mailbag episode. Hit us up by December 19th, tastelandpod@gmail.com.
And I would characterize these broadly as like questions about the culture.
If you're a listener, you know what we talk about. So, you know, culture, media, things, things we've been reading, anything you need the Tasteland take on, the signature Tasteland take, right, Daisy?
Yeah, definitely.
Tasteland.
And if you're anything like me, that voicemail is not going to be, it's not going to be under 10 minutes. I actually did a voice memo bingo for my friends of things that I like repeatedly say.
iMessages voice note wrapped to wrap that up for you, is there?
No, I mean, that would be very funny to have. I think they should do that. But I have like certain phrases that I say. Yeah. Like, I say, I hope you know a lot. I say, to be clear, not in like an Obama inflection.
Let me be clear.
I'll stop in the middle of the sentence and be like, well, whatever. That's life.
You're one of only two people I know who is like a serial voice noter.
This is really only something that started in the last 2 years. I think it's because I have text fatigue.
Yeah. I love text. I love sending five really long texts right after. I love it.
Yeah, and I don't mind that at all. But I think at one point I just made the calculus that this will be easier to say. Here's something that we can talk about. I was Teddy Brown, who was on our podcast to talk about his Zinn article for New York Times, in an act of circling back, asked me to comment for his gift guide article for the New York Times.
Not an act of circling back.
I was like, well, it's not nepotism because we're not related. And maybe networkism. We can talk about what that. That's a thing. I responded to his questions in a voice memo.
And then these are the notes that ended his New York Times style section.
And I ended up with the kicker, which was just don't read them if you don't like them. And but I think I do when I'm leaving a voice memo, I do speak in complete sentences. So I think that helped him.
Yeah. Well, I think for me, I like doing the text because I shouldn't say this as, you know, we go into another hour of podcasting. I feel like I'm smarter as a writer. I sound more stupider when I talk. I hammed it up a bit there. But you know what I mean. Anyways, who
You'll talk pretty someday.
Okay.
We're talking to Trevor McFredries. He is a serial founder. He's also a DJ and musician. I would say he's a true Renaissance man. If you remember Lil Miquela, who was kind of like the first digital influencer, that was Trevor. Friends with Benefits, aka FWB Fest, the place I gave my Base Economy keynote earlier this year, which led to us having a conversation about festivals. Trevor was also very big in getting FWB off the ground. I'm interested to hear from him what he's working on now, because I know a few things. He's working on a bunch of stuff in parallel, some of it public, some of it secret. So we'll see what we can find out from him.
Did you listen to him and I think his girlfriend have this musical duo called Soft, which...
Yes,
did you
Soft.
Listen to the trance remix of Right Back to It by MJ Linderman and Waxahachie?
I actually did listen to that. And I actually have one of their songs on my favorite songs of 2024 list. Let me pull it up.
Nice. I did listen to that song like five times in a row.
I have Heroes Sir Sexy on my favorite songs of 2024 list. But is that MJ Linderman trance remix on Spotify or just SoundCloud? Because I think I only...
It's on SoundCloud and Bandcamp. And I should say, it is Waxahachie featuring MJ Linderman. I missed
Oh my God,
there.
Sorry. Apologies.
I almost bought it Because I switched to Apple Music. Mm-hmm. Formally, actually, I finally canceled my Spotify subscription a couple weeks ago. So now with Apple, you know, I don't know if you can even do that with Spotify.
Did you cancel before the Wrapped because you knew it was going to be embarrassing for you?
No, I know. I've been slowly making the transition over the past couple months.
But did you see my tweet about my Wrapped?
No.
Okay, so do you want to guess what my top band of 2024 was?
MJ Linderman.
No, Third Eye Blind.
Third Eye Blind. I don't even, you know, Third Eye Blind is one of those bands where, like, obviously I know Third Eye Blind. I couldn't name a single song by Third Eye Blind. I don't know the references.
I don't know. I feel like you could.
Well, what's, okay, name one Third Eye Blind song.
Graduation.
Okay.
Well, now I can't name a single Third Eye Blind song.
I'll say this. So across my Spotify and my Apple Wrapped, there was one song that topped them both because I was listening to it a lot.
It's called Graduate. That's embarrassing for me.
When I made the switch, because the way I listen to music is like most of what gets logged on those apps is like while I'm doing work and I'll listen to like one song or one album just on loop.
Mm-hmm,
And so across the two platforms, I listened to Note to Self by Jimmy Stack featuring Empress Of. I listened to it, I think, 475 times. And this is just since since August.
That's wild, Francis. My other top artists of 2024 were, do you know who Bruiser Wolf is?
No, it's like a rapper. I don't know.
Do you know what Bruiser Brigade is? It's like Danny Brown's.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. They're out of Detroit. Okay. So Bruiser Wolf is in that collective. I listened to his 2024 album a lot.
In preparing for this episode, while listening to a podcast Trevor had done recently, I scrolled back through his entire he's here, we'll just let him in.
Hello,
how are we?
I don't know, not much going on in the world, so
not much at all.
Another quiet news week.
I know. I mean, I guess it's the end of the year, we can all ease into the holidays, move on with our lives.
I do, so maybe this is jumping too right into it, but something I saw on Twitter yesterday, I was like, "What? You didn't retweet it, but it was next to a tweet of yours."
You're just gonna affiliate him with it?
Well, I am. No, but I thought he would have something interesting to say about it. Maybe you did retweet it. I don't know. Anyways, the tweet was, "I think we'll look back on creator payouts as a big mistake for X." And then there's a couple of screenshots of tweets introducing, like, you know, big threads. One is like, here's the story of Mark Andreessen. This guy was 22 and then he sold his for blah 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 blah. And the other is the full shocking story of the Hawktua meme coin. So I don't know. I thought that would be an interesting place to start. Do you think, because you're a big tweeter, serial tweeter, do we think creator payouts are a significant contributor to the way Twitter has changed since Elon took over?
I think it will be on the list of like goofs, but I don't think it would be at the top. Like, I do think the blue check mark thing was a pretty serious fiasco. Like, you know, effectively ruined the status games that could be played here.
Eli Lilly Gate.
Yeah, totally. And I do think that like a lot of value accrued to that blue check at some point, and now maybe is like where they probably could have. Where they probably could have extracted the most value, it's probably become like net negative now. Like a lot of coastal elites see it as being like, you know, alt-right. It's an alt-right bumper sticker or something.
Yeah, not getting the blue check as like a sign of protest.
Yeah, and people actively saying like, I didn't pay for this. I don't know how it got here. Like, that's interesting. It's a scarlet letter online. But yeah, I think the thread thing, I'm not a huge fan of all social in general, kind of incentivizing content that keeps people on the page. I think what's interesting about YouTube is that they started in an era where the kind of gamification stuff maybe were a little more nascent. And also because watch time required kind of like narrative and captivating characters, it seems to have like bred a different type of creator. And also it's who you elevate and, you know, put on. I think, you know, you've watched TikTok, whatever, with Charli D'Amelio and, what was the other one? The early kind of TikTokers where they were really elevating like young women that were dancing and doing stuff. I think they kind of defined a character. And now that's become like just pure marketing with like TikTok Shop and, you know, everyone kind of gaming to spam their apps or whatever. I think a lot of these things, to me, it was like spam killed MySpace and a lot of the early social networks. It feels like marketing.
Well, that's interesting because I was thinking too, I hadn't articulated it like that, but like I was thinking about all the different, how these different platforms have it. And I was thinking that only YouTube seems to have like any integrity kind of in the way they do the creator share. And I think it's, you hit on it. It's because, right, like it requires you to watch it for a long time. And it's less of a like the other ones are all about lowest common denominator, get as many eyes on it as possible. And then that's how you generate the value. Whereas YouTube, it's like you can have less and it's just like the longer viewership.
Calories. I don't know. I always think about like there was a old television exec that belief system was basically centered around like making the most inoffensive content. Is what kept people on the network, like whatever wouldn't have you change the channel. And I do kind of see where I like the internet, I think originally was kind of like the shock and kind of like, I guess the rotten.comification of like getting people to engage with stuff. And that could be my own millennial brain rot, but I'm kind of more drawn to that, like the kooky Vine era that became King Batch doing like performative social justice stuff. I much prefer, you know, kids falling off of stacked milk crates than I do, I don't know, threads about Mark Andreessen.
Well, I also think like, I mean, this is pretty obvious and maybe not even worth commenting on, but we're also have to talk about the difference between video and text, and that like with link sharing or platforms that came up to encourage link sharing, you're forcing people to change the channel because all of the information is not contained in the tweet. And in YouTube, it's like, well, all the information is contained in the video. That's why it's a video. And so you can keep people in the quote channel. And I think Elon came in and was like, oh, the best way to prevent people from leaving the platform or changing the channel is, you know, force them to contain all of the information in the tweet. But that did nothing to account for the quality of that information or how people were using it up until that point.
Yeah, quite silly.
Pretty short-sighted.
Totally.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I'm curious what your experience with X or Twitter is these days. Like, I still feel kind of trapped inside the arena, but I suppose the quality's gotten worse, but it's been kind of this slow boil. So I'm aware it's not as good as it used to be, but I can't tell how severe it is.
I've always been more of like a lurker than a big prolific tweeter. Like I have like a public account now that I only made when I started like needing to be on Twitter in like a work way. Whereas before I was just such a like private account consumer and like in group chats and stuff. So for me, like from that perspective, I was never seeking out like such active discussion. Right. So like I was always more just like watching and scrolling and, you know, brain rot, et cetera. But I think I will say that I think obviously the election is like always like a big Twitter event and there's so much to scroll through. You can scroll for hours. But I think that the last week with the Brian Thompson, like the day he was killed and then like the day yesterday that Luigi Mangione was, you know, arrested, that has felt like such a vintage Twitter thing with like an absolute storm of takes with just so many people having so much to say, so little and so much. To me, like this past week, it's like, oh, this is the same as Twitter has always been, really. Maybe with slightly different seasonings or flavors, you know, you get in the far right, whatever kind of thing. But like this past week, it's like, oh, it could have been 4 years ago and it's the same Twitter as it was then.
I think in the past, though, you would have seen breaking news announcements about each development in what was going on before you would see the takes and the memes. And now it's like I get all the takes and the memes immediately and I actually have to dig for the source material. But somebody compared yesterday on Twitter to like when a bird gets into the classroom. It's just like, you know, total distraction. Drop everything that you're doing. Like, we are going to watch this bird.
And do you think older people feel that way? I mean, one of the interesting things is this kid is like Gen Z, handsome, you know, whatever. I have multiple group chats where like friends of friends knew him or knew his family. Mm-hmm. Do you think that, I mean, if you're 50, do you feel like is this bird in the classroom or is this just like another, this is the Boston Marathon bomber where it's like a news thing, but not a social thing?
I think that actually, if you're 50, you're interested in it, not as much in from a memetic perspective, but because this might be idealistic. I think healthcare is an issue that people become radicalized to through either experience or age in the United States. And actually, like, I think what has made this story resonate across age groups is you know, there's the young, really online people who are like interested in, you know, digging into his Goodreads and like talking about political realignment and Teapot and where does this guy fit in? And like, we all know who like Lindy Man is. But then there's people who are like my mom who are like, okay, somebody took a very, very, very extreme step to make a statement about the healthcare industry. I'm obviously going to follow this story because I have lived, you know, almost 70 years in this country, knowing how broken it is, which, I mean, okay, we said, Francis and I were like, let's, we want to talk about the response, we not want to get that political. But Trevor, I feel like I've seen you do,
be political.
I feel like I've seen you do some takes to this effect where it's like, my husband's reading a book right now about ACT UP, the ACT UP movement, and how effective it was in getting treatment for AIDS and recognition of it. I'm like, go through periods where I really believe that that there actually cannot be a unified class movement in the United States, that it would have to be around healthcare specifically. And this kid coming from a very privileged background, I think supports that, but that obviously goes against people who are like true Marxist thinkers on the left, where it's like, it has to be class, it has to be class. And it's like, maybe it could only ever be healthcare. Maybe that's the one issue that we could ever align around.
I mean, like, I can get political, and I don't know if you guys want to, but I think like what's interesting is it's not novel to express the fact that like the left is seemingly allergic to power, right? Like when you create these ideas of oppressors versus like the oppressed, you don't want to become the oppressor. And so the idea of kind of creating real change, which means like attaining power, is repulsive. And I think that paired with the kind of academic theater kidification of like left-wing politics means you effectively have all these people LARPing historical ways of being progressive or left-wing. And so, you know, like I often think about the Black Lives Matter movement or like, you know, the pink pussy hats and the lack of like real policy that came from that, like Nancy Pelosi kneeling in a African dashiki or whatever. And then like the lack of real substantive change. And then I think about, you know, interfacing with circles on the right, where it's like, you know, I'll be in like libertarian tech circles and they're actively weaponizing capital to create real power. You know, like, you know, who's had a better 2 decades than Peter Thiel, right? Like, mm-hmm. You know, you could also actively trade against all the dominant takes on like left-wing Twitter or kind of like mainstream, like MSNBC wine mom Twitter for the last 10 years and like have an incredible portfolio. You betting against Elon, you'd be betting against Bitcoin, you'd be betting against so many of these players. And so all that is to say, like, I think that healthcare is interesting because for me, because I did see like this Ben Shapiro YouTube comments where it does seem this kind of like populist right and populist left can agree something is really broken here. Whether you know, one side wants, you know, Singapore, you know, and the other side
claim denied.
Yeah. That was like pure free market. The other side wants like, you know, single payer. I think what's interesting now is it may force people to sort of pick apart this thing. And healthcare is so dense. Even when I get into it, friends like D.I. Wallach, who's an investor in the space, like it's so dense that I'm still confused as to who's at fault. Seems like insurance companies, but could it be providers? Could it be other folks in the chain? I don't know.
Right. And like after the election, I was talking with my friends about how, you know, populism, and this comes back to your point about power, populism requires an enemy. It requires a shared enemy. And we should have Nick Suzy on as well, because Nick Suzy just did a great presentation about Drake, but also a larger piece, which you probably saw, Trevor, about like how like the way to get attention is to start a war or a feud in some way. And like, if you look at the way that attention is directed, it's always towards some sort of like us versus them thing, whether in entertainment with like Drake and Kendrick, Taylor Swift and Kanye at one point, or politics, who's more comfortable with an us versus them rhetoric. Sure. But obviously the left is not willing to do a style of populism that is anti-immigrant, insider, outsider. In the past, they would have done the enemy is rich people, but now they can't because so many rich people are Democrats and part of their donor base. And it's like, there's no enemy, there can be no populism, and the enemy can't be like who, I mean, there was sort of like a gesture at that this election cycle, but it just wasn't coherent. Like, it can't just be like the enemy is Donald Trump and
people who vote
for him.
I want to reference another Trevor tweet from like right after the election.
Oh.
You were quote tweeting the map that showed like the rightward versus leftward swing of counties. And so you wrote like the spectrum isn't left versus right as much as change versus status quo. Change candidates on either side would have looked very different, in my opinion, which is exactly what I was thinking. Like going back through your Twitter last night, trying to come up with questions for this, and then like thinking about this as well. That like hit a nerve for me. I like stopped on that. I was like, this is so, feels so relevant to this, like, you know, Luigi conversation, where it's like, you know, the people in Ben Shapiro's comments versus like the people on Twitter gleefully making like, you know, Luigi is our leftist hero meme, whatever. It's like, neither of those things are true. He's neither the leftist or the right hero, but it's like, he's this like, represents change, even
right,
if it's chaotic and like, you know, murder, whatever, but it's like, it's change. And like what you were just saying a second ago, where it's like, you know, are the healthcare insurers at fault? Like, where is the root of like the shittiness of healthcare in this country? Like, it doesn't really matter for like the response to this, like where the actual root is. It more just matters that like people are upset. I literally, before 20 minutes before we got on this call, I like checked my mail, and I had gotten like a physical a couple weeks ago, and like part of it was denied, and I'm gonna have to pay for it, right? So it's like, I don't know, now I'm kind of rambling here, but I think that it's not left versus right as much as it is change versus status quo feels very relevant to this.
Totally. And I think the trap for Dems is there's effectively this like neoliberal tunnel vision where, like, you know, they've got this data driven regime. And I often think about that Bezos quote where he's like, it's something like, you know, I find that when the anecdotal evidence and the data doesn't line up, like I go with the anecdotes because there's something wrong with how you're measuring. It's something like that, you know? And I find that to be true. I think that like one of the disorienting things about living in this moment is every day there are like studies that support other sides of the positions, whether it's diet or life extension or whatever it is. And so I think one of the challenging pieces for me is that you interface with a lot of like senior Democratic officials. And like, I've been lucky in that, like, I've been pulled into campaigns and asked to comment on things. And they're like, hey, little Michaela Kai, you're good at digital, social. How do you think about this? And you get in the rooms and it's clear, like, they have no interest in changing. It's like, it's pretty grifty top to bottom. And they're just kind of, you know, they're talking to your face about how this is, you know, the end of democracy. And then they're just finding ways to weasel money to their buddies and ad agencies or whatever it is. And so that was pretty, you know, like definitely black-pilled me. But I think what's interesting is that you can feel that there's this kind of like black pill via osmosis, that people on both sides are pretty frustrated. And what's been interesting, I think, on the right is you've had Donald Trump as a release valve. Someone who would just look you in the face and be like, yeah, this is fucked up. And I often think when I talk to Dems, I'm kind of like rambling now, but like being like spurgy tech boy, having girlfriends who would be like, this happened at work today. I'm like, oh, here's how you fix it. And they'd be like, I don't want you to fix it. And, you know, and it took me going to therapy for them to be like, they just want you to acknowledge that that's bad. Mm. And then like, when I talk with all these senior elites, they're like, well, no, we're giving $45,000 to buy a house. And you're like, no, but they want you to acknowledge that life is tough and they can't afford to buy a home, and they're cruising into their 40s and living in a one bedroom apartment with two kids. You can't just pretend that this policy will solve everything that you're doing. Something like, hear them, feel them, see them. These kind of soft things that don't fit in spreadsheets are very hard for this coastal elite set that calling the shots.
Yeah. Rebecca at Vox had a tweet that was like, again, I feel like we're sort of like two kinds of people style analysis, which is something that I have sort of been tracking. But basically, she was saying, okay, there's no right and left. It's like, have you been black-pilled or not black-pilled? Which is compelling to me as a framework for analysis, if you had to pick one.
I like that a lot. I mean, it's been interesting watching Friends from the Brian Thompson, who, by the way, when you said Brian Thompson, I was like, the guy? Oh, no.
Brian
Subway
Johnson.
And with,
yeah, oh, and like, guy?
But then I was like, oh, the healthcare CEO, because he has been kind of dehumanized in this moment.
Yes.
Like, it's been all Luigi, and then it's just like, this guy who, from what I understand, grew up in Iowa, I think was the University of Iowa, which is where I'm from, and it probably is not entirely dissimilar from a lot of my peers that I grew up with, was just like a guy who wanted to work hard and found a job and climbed the ranks. But all that is to say, it's been interesting in some of my group chats where it's like, some friends are like, I can't believe the discourse. This is heartbreaking. This guy's a father with kids. Mm-hmm. And then the flip side of that is friends being like, I can't believe this doesn't happen more often. Like, you guys don't feel like this is the logical outcome of this situation. And they didn't. And so I don't know, there is a disconnect somewhere, and it could be black-pilled versus not black-pilled. I like that framing.
I also think, like, I was talking about this with my family. Like, I sort of subscribe to the Hannah Arendt theory of violence, which is like, it can only be judged in retrospect whether something was justified based on the change that it possibly makes. Like, you know, it's sort of like a John Brown thing, right? Like, if I obviously don't condone violence or murder, but if something like this did lead to change in the health insurance industry 10 or 20 years from now, it will be seen as justifiable violence. I do believe that. But you can't, like, just because our cultural discourse moves so fast right now, you can't speed run that historical context. It doesn't matter if you've, like, in the past, you have read 3 newspaper articles about it. Now we've all read 2,000 posts. Having read more posts or consumed more about it, that's, people confuse that with the passage of time.
For sure.
And that still doesn't mean that we can situate it in historical context until truly that time has passed. Well, and I think that's something that we lose on a platform like Twitter.
Mm-hmm. It moves so fast, and it's like neither one of these people is really a person. They're just like vessels for meaning. When there's like, mm-hmm. I you know, how many hundreds of tweets have I read? How many, like, 7, 12, 20, like, you know, newsletter issues have I read in the past 3 days or whatever? It's like, that's just so much meaning, like, that's like crammed into my head that I'm not sure, like, what to think of it, to where it's like, now we're just discussing, like, the response to the response, really, more than just the thing. And, like, that's almost what's become more interesting, is like, I don't know, not the thing itself, but the response. And I don't know. I'm just kind of like losing myself even talking about it. Like, it's like,
well, yeah, I mean, it's been interesting for me to, like, so I guess a while back, like, I guess the emergence of, like, Red Scare, and even my friends with, like, new models and some of these things, like, it became clear to me that there was kind of new status games being played, where it was, like, easy to co-opt aesthetics and, like, having to, like, read the literature to engage presented, like, an interesting obstacle where you could create new boundaries to define who was in the in club and who
Hegelian e-girls.
Hegelian e-girls. Like, not for nothing, that was, like, an emergent property that I think stemmed from this stuff. And yeah. I don't think, like, teapot's entirely dissimilar. Like, you found these, like, new arenas where you could spout off about accelerationism or whatever it is. Like, having VCs quote Nick Land is, like, bizarre to me, but I think it's, like, an emergent property of these things. And so
what's
intriguing is that, like, you know, I'm on TikTok now, and I think, you know, you've seen kind of like the end game of what was, like, Joshua Citarella's, like, Politigram, like 13-year-olds.
Famously going to be on the podcast next week.
Let's go.
By famously, I mean, I'm just telling you that for the first time.
Yeah, yeah. No, like, little kids reading Max Stirner or whatever, calling themselves, like, neo-Khomeinists or whatever. Like, what you have now on TikTok is a bunch of kids spouting kind of, like, the most obvious shit in, like, pseudo-academic terms. Mm-hmm. People being like, snap, 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 yes, this. And, like, to me, it feels totally insane. But, like, that to me actually has created a situation where a lot of these people are able to then abstract the humans in this thing and turn them into, like, these academic figures that allow them to, like, you know, talk about ideas that, you know, reinforce the way they see the world instead of thinking about it. Like,
that's like, I never thought about when I was, like, you know, when I was, like, 15 or whatever in English class, and we read about existentialism for the first time. And I'm like, oh, this is, like, I've been looking for my philosophical worldview, like, existentialism, this is it. And, like, that was the thing that you know, 15, I was like 2010 or whatever. Right. So it's like, it never really occurred to me, like, obviously, you know, I've read, like, Josh has seen his graphs and said all this stuff. It never really occurred to me that it's like, instead of discovering existentialism in English class, they're discovering, like, all these much more niche things that you can just dive so deeply into on the internet.
I mean, it's so amazing. I was watching, like, rewatching Sopranos, and that, like, great angle of, like, AJ becoming, like, eco-terrorist, like, getting on the internet and getting, like, pilled. That show's just so good. It has so much staying power, but I feel like that's happening at scale in a big way now.
My friend texted me when we were like 3 minutes into recording this, like, what is teapot? And I wanted to be like, don't worry about it, kitten. But I was like, I'm literally on a podcast, the podcast right now. I'll talk to you after about this. But I'm like, oh God, how do I even explain this? Actually, Trevor, we talk about status games a lot. You've influenced my thinking on it, but I realized we didn't really define it for people listening to the podcast. Can you explain like what you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's funny. I've never like probably tried, but like effectively in all kind of like social life, there are hierarchies and there are games that we play to like move up and down those hierarchies. And I think of those as being like games where you're trying to kind of either increase your status or, you know, maybe move laterally. But I think what's been interesting about the internet is that it's allowed people to kind of like hack sociology and hack psychology. And a lot of app creators have figured out that that's how tribes like to spend their times is like playing status games. And so you create different platforms that enable different types of achievements and then will come in do their status game TikTok dances.
One thing I can't take it back to, there's like one more Luigi Mangione angle I want to talk about. So the writer Catherine D had written a short piece for The Spectator yesterday about, you know, his digital footprint and what to make of it. And there's a couple, I'll read a couple short excerpts from it. So one, Mangione's worldview, to the extent we can piece it together, wasn't pinned to a standard left-right axis, as we already discussed. The closest thing we have is that he seemed convinced that technology and modernity had led us astray. And then she gets to, whatever the case, we are at the dawn of a new era. We have argued endlessly over left versus right radicalization, but this case nudges us to think along a different axis between faith in technology's promise and despair at its hollowing of the human spirit. Beneath the endless streams, apps, and feeds, something essential is slipping away, which the point here that to talk about is, she says, my sense is that we've arrived at the beginning of the real culture war, techno-optimism versus techno-pessimism. In this world, may we all become techno-realists.
Interesting. That's interesting to me. I think, I guess because we are so in it, and I felt like that's been the last, like I felt like 2016 was the moment that culture war kicked off, because it was like, hey, technology brought us Obama, it brought us Facebook, it brought us Google, indexing the world information, don't be evil. And 2016, it brought us Donald Trump. Like that was the consensus. Is that this thing has now been a psyop, it's been controlled by Russians and billionaires, and you watch the narrative shift. And much of my experience in technology over the last 8 years has been like trying to get people excited about a techno-optimist vision that like I was raised in via Wired magazine and Kevin Kelly or whatever else. And so I think, I mean, even like Ted Kaczynski, like obviously I think that's probably the angle that she's taking, is that him reading Uncle Ted and espousing the same kind of like, you know, a desire for the agrarian age or whatever. But I think that to me feels a little lazy. I don't know. I think there's more interesting threads to be pulled on than that. I'm curious what you guys read into that.
I mean, this guy's a programmer who seems to have had a really painful injury and experiences with drugs that basically accelerated his view that like technology is not the solution to a certain type of despair.
Sure.
And I think technology can be the solution to some types of despair. It could also be the source of despair. But that seems to be, to me, like looking at the people he engaged with on Twitter, who I would put in the techno-optimist category, that seems to be like the crux of the motive as like I understand it, which is like, you can believe all of these things and you can study computer science and read all of these thinkers, and then one day like see a tweet also that's like, you can just do things, and that doesn't become applying to YC, it becomes buying a gun. And that act feels more meaningful and real than like a fleet of Waymos, period.
Sure.
A fleet of Waymos, that's a self-driving car. That has been the example of changing the world forever. Sure. But you know what else changes the world? Shooting somebody.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. There seems to be this kind of like cosmic pendulum, you know, like I don't want to call it like,
ooh, the cosmic invisible pendulum. That's a great name for something.
Yeah. My new liquid drumming bass duo. but I think, you know, I don't want to call it like an invisible hand or kind of like a cosmic market force, but like there was this kind of like trendy 90s Dawkins atheist kind of like extremely material view of the world that kind of like fedora reddited brained a lot.
Oh, like men. Richard Dawkins?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that his name?
Totally, yeah. But like, you know, this kind of atheist view. Mm-hmm. And I think as technology's accelerated, you've kind of cruised deeper. Like I found God again by building an AI. Like at some point you get deep enough where you're like, we're definitely not computers, we're radios, you know? Mm-hmm. And like, if you were to smash the radio, you'd think this thing created the sound, but it doesn't create the sound, it receives the sound. And I think that like people like Luigi and the teapot world stare down this barrel and they either like retreat into this, like, that sounds like nonsense. I'm going to double down on kind of this Dawkins-esque worldview and or kind of accept that there is a higher thing and that they're merely like a small player in that thing. And so I think all this to say, this idea that like the tech community as being this monolith of math and science, I think they're going to be forced to become like magic and God people, because effectively what AI is oftentimes is casting spells. Like a prompt is, and then you hope a thing comes back, and 7 out of 10 times it does. Like, we're going to have to accept that there will be kind of AI born, you know, bio advances where we don't know how they work. Like, you're taking this pill and it cures a thing and we don't know, but the God above gave us this spell and it works. So we keep putting leeches on it or whatever it is. Like, I think the return to magic is going to be real, and it's going to soften the edges on a lot of these things and make it more palatable to the EQ set.
Where do you think network spirituality fits into all of this?
Well, I think that's exactly right. That's like a generation of, I think, of like really observant young people, like the Romelia set. Like they've been able to identify that there are like voices and spirits in the machines. And that they're important and that you should acknowledge them. And like, even the kind of mantra I see more and more of, like, we made the rocks talk. Like, you know, with thinking about like transistors and chips, like you've turned silicon into thinking machines. Like, that's fucking wild. That's spiritual. That's like voodoo. And I think that like, there's going to be a return to that kind of thinking. And I think it'll make it more palatable and easier for people to accept techno-optimism that's rooted in kind of like a humanist and like spiritual world.
I'm reminded of like the last few days, there was a few articles I read, and I'm probably gonna like confuse which ideas I got from which ones, but I didn't read, there's like the Casey Newton piece about like AI. He was making some case for AI, and then Edward Anguissa Jr. made in his Substack had this long piece like kind of disputing every part of that, and I think maybe he wrapped it up in this way, or it was then what I read in Ryan Broderick's Garbage Day newsletter kind of wrapping up the two, where it's like, the point is that AI, it's not that like AI is like terrible and evil, or that it's like good and positive, but it's all of these things at once. And it's like, I don't know. So like, thinking about techno optimism versus techno pessimism, it's like, I don't like how can you be one or the other really, when it just is the reality? You can't put, there's so much toothpaste. There's tubes and tube. There's liters, gallons of toothpaste out of the tube. The tube is, we can't put it back in. Right. So I don't know. I haven't really delve much into like thinking about it in this like magical sense that you're talking about, but I like that. I think like, because for me too, where I land on that is like AI as a term, right, is like so meaningless to me. Like I, you know, like I'm not such a techie person where I understand exactly how LLMs work and all that, but like I think of AI as basically meaning a term that just means like a computer that's really fast and good at pattern matching. And like, you know, it's not so different from like a computer 10 years ago. It's just that this one's faster, and AI just means fast computer.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I don't know if you want to interrogate like AI and like what it means, but like, I think you could describe like an intelligent human as someone who effectively is like really good and fast at pattern matching, right? Mm-hmm. Like effectively that's learning. You're like hearing someone point at your little brother is pointing at your mom and saying mom, and you're going, oh, if I point at her and say mom, she responds, I'm going to like double down on that pattern and get attention or whatever it is. All that is to say, like, I think that's like, yeah, that's like been the most obvious tech take for a long time. As long as I can remember it, is that like these things are neutral, and effectively how you use them can define whether they're good or bad. I think what's interesting to me is like how we're going to interrogate the definition of like progressivism I think that, like, I see technology explicitly as like doing more with less or the same, right? Like, that's just, you know, it's enabling more. And progressivism for me was always about doing more for people. Mm-hmm. And I think what's interesting is like that became doing more for people who have less than others. Man, that makes sense too. And it slowly shifted into like doing more for those who have a certain identity mm-hmm. that are aligned with. And I was like, interesting. I guess that makes sense. The cash all, it's easier. And then at some point I was like, actually, I don't like that at all. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in helping people explicitly. And if that means helping people that have less, more so, I'm for that also. And I think as those things diverge, when it became about helping a certain identity, it became clear that like doing more with less may actually mean that you impact those people with a certain identity. And those things started to kind of have a certain amount of dissonance. And if they return to like doing more for people, I think technology and progressivism begin to align again. But otherwise, you see it fragmenting, and it may have already fragmented beyond repair. And this is kind of a left. It's, you
know. My issue as somebody who is interested in technology and using it to fulfill like things that I think are important, support things that I think are important, and like direct capital around them. I totally agree that we're entering an age of humanism and technology by necessity. My issue is the people who have capital and power right now in Silicon Valley were not selected for their skills as humanists, and their companies and the way things were funded were not optimized towards humanism. And so we're stuck with this group of leaders and people and founders who were good at what they were selected for, which was building unicorns and scaling. And in some instances, like, you know, being on the spectrum in a way that would allow them to ignore a type of humanism that might have made those companies smaller. But I think the issue is like, I'm not really interested in those people refashioning themselves as humanists, because I don't think you can have people pivoting to writing threads about humanism that think like books can be replaced by ChatGPT. But there is no pipeline empowering, selecting, directing capital towards people that have the skill sets that were ignored during, like, you know, the ZERP era, whatever you want to call it. ZERP is a bit of a myth. We've covered that on this podcast. But like, you could say like broadly the last two decades, like, yeah, Mark Zuckerberg was the person to build Facebook. Is Mark Zuckerberg the person to be the voice of like post-AI tech humanism? Like, probably not. He's a family man. He's a nice guy, but like, he wasn't selected to do that.
It's interesting, right? And I think this is exactly like the kind of thing we're going to need to figure out how to discuss with like the accurate language, because I think if you were to describe Elon Musk, it'd be someone who cares deeply about humans and not very much about people, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I would say like, you know, Larry and Sergey to a lesser extent, and Elon maybe more so than Larry and Sergey, like are exactly the same way. Like they're thinking very much about humanity broadly. Elon mm-hmm. wants to create Plan Bs and save the environment. But if that requires crushing the janitor who, you know, got something wrong, like he'll absolutely crush the janitor, right? Mm-hmm. He'll crush anyone to get to this thing. And I think that is where we've had this divergence. And I think it's going to be interesting. I mean, that was, to me, is kind of like techno-optimism 101. It was just like this utilitarian vision of doing what's required to help the great, to do the greater good. And
everything is a trolley problem.
I mean, everything is a trolley problem. Yeah. And as I'm able to atomize it and kind of give everyone a voice via these things, you've now humanized those people on the tracks. Mm-hmm. And it creates a lot of icky feelings for people. And I think that's the challenge, is that like, if you're Elon, if you're Mark, you're at a certain elevation where you're like, how could you possibly dislike me? I'm the person who's done the single most for humanity in the last 2 decades. You could argue that Elon Musk single-handedly has done more than anyone in the last 2 decades. Mm-hmm. And he'd be like, well, how could you possibly dislike me? The thing you talk about the most is climate change. That's me. You know what I mean? Like, and so I don't know. I think we're going to have to figure out language. And if we want some of these people who are goal-oriented and when given the right boundaries can do impressive things, I think a lot of them feel bait and switched in that, like, in the Obama era, they were heroes because the boundaries and the conditions they were given, they met and surpassed. And Amazon made it really easy to get anything you want. Like, what an incredible premise to someone in fucking Oregon Trail that, like, push a button and it's all at your disposal. And so I think the idea of becoming a villain is quite easy because you're like, wait a minute, like, I did this all for you and you turned on me? Fuck you guys. Actually, if you think I'm this, then fuck you, I am that. Mm-hmm. And so I think if instead we're able to, like, you know, say, actually, the boundaries we gave you were close, but directionally a little bit off. Here's what we actually are looking for. You would see a Patrick Collison or whatever, like, achieve those things. And maybe this return to kind of like being excited about these people or like bringing them into the tent instead of saying, fuck you, scapegoat. We're gonna.
Well, I want to bring up another tweet of yours from 2 months ago.
So this is great where somebody starts citing your tweets too.
I did go back and I read every tweet of yours in 2024. I will admit that.
Stop! Don't admit that.
God bless you.
You know,
I did not do that.
That's
for the record.
That's my cross to bear. That's
you're reading them in real time, Daisy. Come on.
But okay. Anyways, the tweet was: there's this weird thing happening where social has incentivized selling picks and shovels, but there's no gold rush. Just people selling courses on how to sell courses, which I think is a bit of what we're talking about here, but more on like the everyday internet user level, not the Elon and the Zuckerberg, but like the other people. And that to me speaks to like kind of this bit of a logical conclusion of like that, like what they were selected for 15 years ago to like build these companies. This is what trickles down where it's like, it's about making money on the internet. It's about this, like the internet casino, obviously this tracks like crypto too. I don't know, curious for you to expand more on like kind of what you were getting at in that tweet.
I think what I struggle with is, again, like, you know, I think like Julian from Numerology calls it like autism creep. Like effectively this worldview of very concrete, discrete systems and the game being to like win that system has created like some kind of perverse outcomes. Meaning that, you know, I'm 38 years old. I came up on the internet, but also was aware of kind of like a softer spiritual goal of actualization, meaning that like I wanted to be an artist and I wanted to create things and I wanted those things to like make the world a better place. And there's something soft and special about that. And when I discovered MySpace, I realized I could write JavaScript that would make people auto-friend me. Or whatever, you know? And so it was like, cool, I can get lots of friends here, in which case I can have lots of influence and the things that I make can impact people at a greater scale. Awesome. I can build a blog. I can build a brand. I can read Cialdini and other people and kind of like learn to hack human psychology such that they can pay attention to me and then I can do great things. And what's interesting is that people in my generation started like recognizing that, building personal brands, and then recognizing they needed something to do with that attention. So they became photographers, fashion bloggers, you know, DJs, things that have really low barriers to becoming good. And what's interesting now is like, if you interface with young hype house TikTokers, you're like, amazing. Like, or Mr. Beast, like you won this game. Like you're the best at creating YouTube thumbnails and capturing attention. Like, what do you want to do with that? And I'm like, I want to win the game. I'm like, I won the game. And you're like, yeah, but like, the actual game, the meta game was like doing shit that like helps the world. Now you capture all this attention, like, and you talk to them and they're like, I'm going to create a fund. Why would I do anything? Like I can just sell attention and I can like invest and I can get rich. Like I don't need to do anything. And so that to me is like the champions of this current way of existing on the internet. And the trickle down of that is all these people that are just like effectively selling courses to the gold rush, which is there is no actual goal. Like the gold rush is winning this game, not living and actualizing and doing things that matter outside of a bank account or a follower account or these things that you can measure with numbers on a screen. And so that's probably why I tweeted it, because it's not as concrete as I'd like it to be, but it does feel frustrating that there isn't a kind of higher calling to capturing all this attention, even if it was like getting laid. Like when I meet band dudes that were like, I started a band because I wanted to get laid. I'm like, it feels more fucking noble than like
It's authentic.
Selling shapewear on TikTok shop.
I just read this like MIT press book called Content by this media theorist person, Kate Eichhorn. And she was talking about this idea of content capital, which maybe you've talked about this before, but I hadn't heard the term before. But basically, kind of the way I paraphrased it is it's like, it's your reach, it's your following, it's your, I think kind of the logical conclusion to it is it's your ability with your presence on the internet to like affect some material thing. And it's like, maybe it's like your ability to convert it to social capital, financial capital, all the other types of capital, right? But the way you're talking about that is like these people who are like producing content capital purely for the sake of producing more content capital. And then there's this other great line in the book that's just content begets content, right? Which is like kind of, I mean, that's what this podcast is, as we talk about other content anyways. But I don't know. To me, that's what that is it's just this like endless wheel of content that begets more content that begets maybe financial capital, and just like to no end. Like there's no end to it.
And that, yeah, and I think that to me feels okay, like narratives and stories and the way they manifest. But I guess the stories, and maybe this is me being romantic, and maybe it's because these are the ones that have persisted throughout time, but like if the story is the Bible or like, you know, hymnals were kind of by slaves or whatever, like if these stories that were passed on are meaningful, I'm interested in like content begetting more content. But the empty calories of it all, I think that's like the challenge for me, is that like we haven't created great systems for like measuring sustenance, you know, like it's just empty calories constantly. And I think that's what's frustrating. And I guess some part of me is struggling with like, is that am I just old and my like axes for understanding like the kind of like quality of these things is like antiquated, or should I be actively helping young people and being like, no, like you can make things that matter, like they don't need to be disposable,
right? Like your Aura ring is not going to tell you how well you are in terms of like how meaningful you feel like your life is. People realize they're missing some component of wellness, but there's no like way to measure that outside of spirituality, which is how we end up with like more wellness content as a solution to the problem that was created. And I just want to jump real fast back, because I really like this distinction between people who are focused on humans and people that are focused on people. And I think like we need actually more creators and people in the media industry who like understand the distinction and like can do both. Because if you're too far left on the spectrum, you're very focused on people, you miss the human aspect, which does require accumulating power and capital in order to have the influence to serve people. But then you have, like, from the founder perspective, think about somebody like Bill Gates, whose career is sort of bifurcated between the human era, which is create Microsoft, good for humanity, bad for a lot of individual people, arguably. And then you have the people era where you eradicate malaria. And it's like two chapters. But what if they had to be the same chapter? And what if the people who got capital and were privileged in culture, but also were privileged in the world of Silicon Valley, were the people that were the best of keeping an eye on both at the same time? This has never occurred before. And I feel like that's sort of what we're talking about here. But like, also correct me if I'm wrong.
I don't know. Yeah, I think it's a really tough one, right? Like, you could argue that like Steve Jobs was that character, or, and like, you know, it's kind of a product of this kind of like hippie California thing. And I always think about him getting pitched the idea of like streaming music. And he was like, that's bullshit. People should own their media, you know? And I think there's kind of a humanist quality in what Steve Jobs did that prevented slop. And I think as you've moved away from Steve, you see like Apple Vision Pros emerge, where you're like, interesting, technically, what value does it add to the human experience? And there are constantly things where I'm like, Steve would have killed that. Again, it could be romantic and looking backwards. And I don't know. I think one of the challenges, like I lived in France for a bit, and it was interesting because it was so people focused, right? Like everyone I engaged with, it was funny because like you talk to friends and, you know, they'd be like, Taylor Swift is flying private, disgusting. And I'd be like, but you would if you could. They're like, absolutely not. I would never. And you're like, really? Oh, and they fucking wouldn't.
French people?
Yeah, like my French homies, or young people. They'd be like, absolutely not. It's disgusting that you Americans would even consider doing that. And you're like, oh.
They have better trains than us.
They have better trains, for sure. But what also was intriguing is because they're so fixated on the people piece, they lose sight of the kind of like humanity piece. And we'd have these arguments about like Teslas, and they'd be like, yes, man, you know, like the rivers are being poisoned in Africa because they're pulling lithium out of the ground. And you're like, I understand that, but like ecology and climate change are two different things. Like climate change is like impending doom that kills all of us. Ecology poisons this river and fucks over like a tribe of Africans. That sucks for sure. But again, like utilitarian tech hat on, you'd be like, well, we got to save humanity. And if we poison 1,000 people, that sucks, but it's humanity. And they're kind of incapable of seeing the other way. And so I think, I don't know, it's been fun to kind of have that dialectic for my Hegelian e-girls. But I'm not sure where I land on like how we split the difference, or if it just is this kind of cosmic pendulum of like you push hard in one direction and then the universe pushes you harder in the other direction. And you have these sweet spots where we have 50 years of no conflict. And now as the pendulum swings back, you know, war with China, Ukraine, Syria.
One other thing I found while preparing for this is when you're on the Context Pod a couple months ago and you're talking about this idea how there's no finality on the internet. And that is what I was thinking about as we were talking about this. And I think the human scale versus the people scale. I think the people scale is about finality. And like if you're owning your media, that media can, you know, a record can be destroyed, whatever. If you're streaming, that can't be destroyed. Like whatever, the service could be destroyed, whatever, but it's this endlessness, et cetera. And then when I think too about like doing actions on the scale of humanity and like saving humanity, one thing, like, you know, eventually on every scale, cellular scale up to species scale, things die, right? And so I think like this idea of doing things on the human scale and like Elon Musk working to, you know, help the save the environment or whatever, it's like you're just pushing that, right? And this idea of like building on Mars, it's like that human scale tries to ignore a finality, that humanity scale tries to ignore a finality, I think, which is like good because you shouldn't death. Like, accept death, right? But like you also actually kind of have to. And I don't know, maybe this is too much. I'm kind of probably wrapping up the pod here, but I'm thinking about that a lot where like the way we're talking about humanity scale seems to ignore this idea of finality that's, you know, part of the people scale and part of every, from the cellular scale up, right?
Well, I was talking to my friend this week, sorry to jump in, but like she's a professor, a creative writing professor. And she says, like, you know, the first thing she tells her students, or what she feels like she's ultimately teaching her students, is like, you are going to die and everyone that you love will die. And I think the starting point of the humanities is to accept and cope with death. And that's a big part of humanism, that if you believe the ultimate project is to defeat death, you are at odds. And maybe they can meet in the middle around some sort of spirituality, which is like, what part of life continues? But to accept human death does feel like the core of all art. And Francis, I don't know if you read any of my tweets, you might just read Trevor's, but I did tweet today that
I read all your tweets, Daisy.
Okay. All media is future lost media. But I would say all technology is future lost technology.
Yeah. What was the song you were tweeting that about?
Somebody found like some emo CD in a store that they really liked, and there was just like no record of the band on the internet anywhere.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah.
What a blessing.
Right.
No, I'm
sorry, sure that can't be me.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. I often think about like, I don't know, like you hang so many founder circles and like effectively you've got a bunch of sickos who are like, who actively believe they can beat death either via like bronze statue that exists in the square indefinitely, or like a planet they colonized being named after them, or
well, that's
or
even just like what being a VC funded company is about, right? Is like that beating the odds to grow. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, but like even the silly ones, you know, like I want to build a generational life insurance company, and you're like, what? Like, you want to do this your whole life? Like, it is kind of, and but like, they have to believe it, and that's why they get funded, and that's why they do well. But it's again, I think there's kind of like a tension there that I think is important. And I think actually, as I've gotten older, like, I'm really thankful that like Rashida, Tlaib, or like Ben Shapiro exist, because I think you need these people pulling at other ends of the spectrum. And I think it's like lazy and kind of like, you know, counterproductive to suggest that like any people should go away on either side. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm really thankful that there are Brian Johnson of the world trying to beat death. And maybe on the flip side of that, while it kind of like breaks my heart, I think there are, it's compelling and important that there are people that are actively trying to you know, have the right to die. And that tension, I think, is probably important in humanity and creates a conflict that gives this fucking bizarre thing meaning.
Right. I mean, I happen to believe the whole point of life is love, and that's probably why I will never be rich. But that's okay.
I think that's a perfect place to end it. This
no,
has been
no.
Yeah, let's end it. Thanks for coming on, Trevor.
Thanks, Trevor.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.